sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Europe makes a bonehead move on the Cyprus bailout. Consumer confidence falls abruptly in March, and inflation is finally ticking up. We also have Tom McClellan with us today and Carter Worth. All this and much more on episode number 305 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, happy St. Patrick's Day to all of you out there celebrating, and for those of you that are not celebrating, why aren't you? It's a great time of year. When we start seeing seasons change the clocks. My birthday is coming up in a few days. And you know what? It is an interesting time when it comes to markets as well. We have a couple of great guests on today. And I lined them up because I wanted to talk about some of the non-emotional aspects of the market and talk about kind of the numbers, just the numbers, only the numbers, and give some factual representations on direction, trend, and what to maybe look for. I think we'll learn a lot because Tom McClellan always brings us some really interesting insight with regard to how when he crunches the numbers and uses a variety of indicators and does some, you know, he does a lot of this work that looks at forward indicators and how they then react to make up what the potential future for a different indicator is. So, for example, he uses a lot copper and makes a kind of offset on charts to look at how copper has reacted over the recent time and maybe what the correlation is to that and maybe the S&P or maybe to other particular industries indices. So we're going to talk with him. And also, first time on the show, we have Tom is being joined by Carter Worth. We're going to have them as separate interviews. But Carter Worth is a well-known market technician, and we'll talk with him as well. But I thought we'd start off with a conversation that we started last week with Das. If you remember, we talked about this whole Cyprus bailout issue and what's going on or what could be going on. And it seems that there's a lot of surprise in the markets and a lot of people I've been reading that have been like, wow, I can't believe they did this, in that they never thought that this was even on the table. Well, Das brought to us very interesting information, advanced information, on the fact that they were looking to clip depositors in this kind of bail-in, bail-out situation with Cyprus, which was well underwater and on the verge of bankruptcy. So Cyprus, over the weekend, accepted, it seems, a bailout where there's going to be about $10, $12 billion or so put into their system. It's a very small country, but they have a lot of debt compared to their GDP and compared to what they can handle in their debt service. And what happened is that there was also an agreement that there would be a, quote, tax on depositors, somewhere about 6% under 100,000 euros and about 9% or so over 100,000 euros if there was deposits in the bank. Now, what does that mean? Well, there was a requirement of a lot more money that was necessitated to actually bail out the Cyprus situation and their banks. And what happened was that the EU came in and said, you know, we'll give you this much and you're going to have to make up the rest by hitting your depositors. In other words, haircuts, although they don't call it that, they call it a tax. And somehow I think that they believe that the word tax is somehow a different connotation, and it kind of brings on a different feeling than if we said, hey, you know what, here's the deal. You're going to have to take losses as depositors, or you're going to have to take haircuts, or we're going to actually take part of your money because there are losses. And when you look at it as a tax, I'm not sure if there is this concept that's being brought forward about a loss. Whether or not there's going to be a default, an actual default called on this, which there should be, or not, so the CDS will kick in, we'll have to see. But what they've done is essentially created a haircut for the depositors. So to give you the feeling of what this is all about, you know, can you imagine that you have your money in a bank and any of the banks. And because of the requirement that this bank has to have a bailout, they say, you know what? You know, your $100,000 that's with us is now only worth $90,000. You say, wait a second, whoa. What happened to the FDIC, right? What happened to the implicit guarantees that the ECB made for all the banks? Well, you know, we'll back you. We're not giving you a loss. We're just charging you a tax. And the tax was taken out of the account over the weekend when the accounts were shut. So therefore, you had no opportunity, if you didn't do so in advance, to actually take out your money. So don't tell me the crap that they're trying to pull, that this is a tax. It is a clear loss. It's a haircut on depositors. Now, let me give you a little bit more thought on this, because I was kind of thinking about this in a conversation after the conversation we had last week with Das, and I spoke with him. You know, if you really think about this, this is a really bad precedent. And even if it isn't done again in the near future by Spain, Portugal, Italy, think about this. If you're a depositor in a bank in any of the peripheral countries, what are you going to do? You're going to be starting to think, wait. Are you telling me that they took money out of my account or people's accounts and I have money sitting here in banks that are in trouble? What if they need another bailout? And if this is the way they're going to be doing things, I'm not so sure I want to have my money there. In other words, this is a great way to create a run on the banks, particularly in Cyprus. No question about that. Greece, secondly, of course. Why would a foreign investor, any investor, want to have their money there? As a matter of fact, the ATMs were closed over the weekend in Cyprus, and there was a lot of money leaving the country already in advance of this. Some people don't have the option. You know, where would you put your money if it wasn't a U.S. bank? Well, you have very few options. You could try to do an offshore account. You could try to do an overseas bank. But again, that's not as easily said as done for the average investor. So this is, I believe, going to cause a real problem here. The potential for risk spreading, risk off trading, the euro getting hammered, at least for a couple of days, money flowing into the dollar because it is the safest place with the FDIC insurance, assuming they don't come up with this bizarre tax situation as well, and money flowing back to the yen. There is no reason that they should have done this, because that extra few billion dollars, which may seem like a lot of money, but in the big scheme of things, is it, really could have stopped a gigantic question mark about what the future will hold if there is the requirement for additional funding for these banks all across the European region. We'll see what happens when markets open through Sunday night on the currency and futures and into Monday morning, but this does not seem like it is a very healthy situation. Whether or not it is contained, whether or not there is going to be a run on the banks, there's going to be a kind of a pull of all the banking assets or a lot of banking assets from the weaker countries into the stronger, I would think there's going to be a lot of buying of U.S. treasuries, and I would think German bunds, possibly putting money into Japan. And you know, I think there's going to be a rise in the valuations of the of the yields of the countries, like I said, of Italy, Spain, Portugal, possibly France. It's going to be a little bit of a question mark, and I think people are going to be a little bit taken aside because this is something that has definitely changed the complexion of what the ECB and the EU had implicitly told everybody. And you know, just to keep us together, now they're going to start hitting depositors. Really, really bad precedent. We'll end it with that, but I do encourage you to listen to last week's podcast with Das, because we did talk about this a bit. Consumer confidence did fall to about 71. That was a pretty big drop, the lowest we've seen in a year and change. And the expectations were for about a 78. Now, oftentimes we see that the numbers are revised a little bit higher throughout the three-period revisions that we get from the University of Michigan over the next few weeks. But you know what? This makes sense. I was kind of scratching my head saying, you know, how is consumer confidence so high when we have all these things that are coming together? You know, we have the stock market is doing better throughout the beginning of the year, but we have the sequestration issue that's been in the news, and we have the fact that you're getting lower amount of wages due to the payroll tax issue, and the gas prices seemed a little bit weird and how it was possible. Same thing's happened with manufacturing. You know, how is it possible that we had a good manufacturing number last month when all the regionals weren't doing well and when factory orders are slipping? Remember I talked about that? But yet we saw a decent number. Is it that there's some delay in some of this for some reason, that the actual numbers come out maybe, I don't know, you know, a month later, possibly. We'll see some of that this week because we're going to be seeing the Philly Fed again. We're going to be seeing the market manufacturing number that comes out, not as well followed as the ISM, of course, but we'll see a little bit of a hint of what's going on. We're also going to see building information. We're going to see homeowners, home information, housing starts coming up this week. Estimates are about 2.8% on the upside, where last month they fell about 8.5%. We're going to have the Fed talking. They changed their times. They were releasing it a little earlier and then talking and having a meeting later, and they're kind of going to smush it together now and have it a lot closer together, so there's no longer that big gap that's going to be happening. We have existing home sales at the end of the week and leading indicators. So leading indicators are expected to be about 0.3. Now, it was interesting. Last week, we saw that the CPI ticked up to 0.7, the highest it's been in a very, very long time. And that 0.7, of course, was the headline number. The actual underlying core number was still relatively benign, a 0.2 comparatively. But what was interesting was that, you know, we saw this gigantic move higher in pricing, of course, for energy products. Other than that, we saw pretty much a deflationary process that's happening. But energy products across the board jumped 8%, 5%, depending on which particular commodity it was. Food costs stayed relatively benign. There was some increases in meats and poultry. We saw a little bit more in breakfast cereals and things like that. I mean, kind of it was all over the place. But the fact is that there are some indications that inflation is starting to kind of sneak in there. And of course, it depends on what you look at. It depends on, you know, core versus the headline number. But headline number is what you and I spend. You and I actually have to deal with, because we include gas, we include food in our numbers. Unless we live in a cave somewhere and don't eat, we don't drive anywhere, then we can go by core. But in the end, the headline number is what we are really dealing with. Now, retail numbers came out. I think they were relatively soft. The only thing that really did well, again, very, very well, was gasoline stations and gas convenience shops. Other than that, everything looked horrible. So when we look at retail sales, and then we saw this drop off in some of the retail indices, and then we saw some of the other companies recently, whether it was the big box, a few of them did well, Macy's did well, and we saw that Nordstrom's did not. We saw that, you know, Aeropostale came in with a questionable number. There was some definite downside predictions by companies. I mean, we're looking at this being the last in the big move on retail. So thinking that that could be something you want to look at. I also mentioned that you want to watch the yen. The yen did a big reversal on Friday. It was up almost 80 basis points, right at 95. I think there's going to be some more pressure on the upside there after the news finally came out of, you know, the election of who's going to be in charge of the Bank of Japan, you know, kind of on a sell the news concept right now. So I want you to pay attention to the yen and the euro moving into next week, because there could be a reversal happening after that sharp run-up that we saw in the yen. Or I should say the, you know, sharp run-up, but the price valuation of it against the dollar actually moved lower. So depends on which side of it you look at, if you're looking at the futures or if you're looking at the spot. But the bottom line is that the currency has been weakening significantly. And take a look at some of the futures, the what we call the JY. The JY future is the Japanese yen future. And you can take a look at where that's going. And there is some room on the upside here to see about, you know, a good, probably a 3% move the opposite direction, which is very substantial when it comes to the yen. I mentioned last week that the KRI, the key reversal indicator, was flashing a warning sign on Friday. Put that post out Friday morning at about 8 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, there was that, well, it wasn't a sell-off on Friday. There was definitely some selling pressure on Friday. Big volume because it was quadruple witching out day. And, you know, you have to look at this as, it, you know, it was a precursor that we saw that the yen was getting a lot of money pushed into it. Dollar dropped, and then we saw the euro move up. But was there something in the air about the Cyprus bailout over the weekend that was spooking investors and kind of having them reposition some of their assets? We'll see what happens with that. The other thing I want to mention to you is that two things. First, I was thinking about, you know, this Cyprus bailout and some of the things that are going on, and that Timothy Geithner is no longer the Treasury Secretary. And, you know, we called him the kneecapper for some time because it seemed that when he was around, all sorts of strange things behind the scenes were going on, and that there was always a mysterious, you know, weekend or overnight something that happened that just solved every problem by just shoving cash into it and doing some really sneaky moves. Now we don't have him anymore, and now Jack Lew is in there with very little business experience other than being involved in politics. And, of course, Geithner was a Goldman boy, and so he knows how to kind of work it, so to speak. And I was thinking that, you know, is he going to be able to give the advice like Geithner did that was so impressive and so distasteful, but so, you know, strong and helped all these regions really do what they had to do to create investor confidence and bring back confidence to markets, et cetera, with doing a lot of the helping of the various parties. So I'm kind of thinking that, you know, this Jack Lew may be really not so good for overall confidence and decision-making if he's not going to be really hardcore like we saw with the last two Treasury secretaries that we had that would kind of really stretch the rope, if you will, to try to get things done any way possible. Before we get to our guests, I want to mention Netflix. You know, Comcast came out with a free weekend, all-you-can-eat kind of service to get people more acquainted with what's happening and maybe also show their competitive advantage or at least their competitive side to Netflix. Netflix really has been running on, I think, fumes. And there was some great new features out. They put out that House of Cards. That was a kind of a cool thing. And, you know, they were seemingly getting back some of the subscriptions and all, but really not to say that the stock should be blasting up to these levels compared to where they were. Valuation still is very, very high. Netflix has a gigantic hole below the 179 level, and I would look at the chart and take a look at the post that we did last week, I think on Thursday or Friday, about, as we call it, sinkhole alert. Netflix clearly has a very big downside potential if we start seeing that there are people that start selling the shares, taking the profits from that gigantic run-up that recently happened. So I'd keep an eye on Netflix and make sure that if you are in the market to find some shorts, of course, this is a very low, very tight float. So what's going to happen there is if, in fact, there is a short squeeze ever, it kind of moves up very fast. But at the same time, when they start pulling out and they start selling, well, you get the opposite reaction. You got to be fast with it. You got to pick your price targets. And you got to kind of move in with conviction when it occurs. So breaking down below about 179 is something that I'd definitely take a look at. Let me mention GoToMeeting. You know, GoToMeeting is, I believe, you know, it's the place to find a benefit for you if you're a successful person. You know, teamwork is so important, and successful businesses always work with teamwork. And you meet face-to-face a lot of times, but, you know, what if you can't? Sometimes your coworkers are spread across the country, across the globe, and, you know, it's sometimes very difficult to get together. So that's why I use GoToMeeting with HD Faces. And the powerful and simple way to meet and collaborate online is terrific. So with GoToMeeting, it just takes a really couple of clicks, and you could share your screen, and you could work on documents there. You could have a webcam. You could talk to each other, et cetera. It's like meeting in person, really. So you could even present from your iPad. Now, you can go to simply get a freebie at GoToMeeting.com and click the try it free button. Use the promo code podcast and you get 30 days of free GoToMeeting so that you can check out how great it is also. GoToMeeting.com, click the try it free and use the promo code podcast. So with that, let's see what we got next. Let's talk to some of our peeps that we have coming on today, because I think this is going to be an exciting conversation. How about we get right with Tom McClellan? He hasn't been on in a while, but this is a great guy. I read his work all the time because Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to be with you.
One of the things that I really like about your work is that it is by the numbers. You know what I mean? In other words, you're really looking at and focusing on the facts as opposed to trying to be necessarily predictive by 700 different kinds of information sources.
Well, you know, I'm happy to be predictive, but the problem is that each and every day I can construct a bullish or a bearish argument out of the indicators that I watch. It depends on which way you want to lean. And the trick is learning which ones to listen to which days.
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't been going that well this week because I've been expecting the market to correct. And so far, all the indications that say the market's going to correct are being trumped by the one big thing that matters, which is that the Fed keeps pumping in lots of money.
Yeah.
And that seems to matter.
So I was thinking about this the other day. And, you know, if markets let's say that the Dow Jones was down, you know, 10, 12 days in a row, and it was kind of, you know, getting a little bit ugly, maybe not a horrible correction, but, you know, we'd have a lot of people trying to instill confidence in the markets, right? You have the Fed marchers coming out in their parade. You'd have the, you know, congressman here and there. How come nobody comes out when things are just moving in one direction on the way up and say, hey, people, calm down?
No. You're asking, what is the opposite of some political leader coming out and saying that the economy is fundamentally strong?
Right.
You know, we don't see the opposite of that when you have a persistent linear uptrend.
Right.
Up and down are just not the same in the market.
Yeah, we're not going to hear something like, hey, you know what? I got to tell you, gang, you're moving up this market and, you know, there's a lot of real headwinds out there and bad things. Politicians don't do that. I hear you. But one of the things that you did and you do quite regularly because it is so important is you put a chart with the purchases of the Fed, and you correlate that and look at the various, really the daily purchases by the Fed of fixed income assets, mortgages, or the treasuries. And why don't you tell us, if you can kind of give us a visual through discussion of what that's all about and how that why that's so important.
Sure. The jargony word that people use to describe that is POMO, P-O-M-O.
Yeah.
Which is an abbreviation for Permanent Open Market Operations that the Fed does. And that's another way of saying that the Fed prints some money, hands it to a banker, and the banker hands over a treasury bond, and the Fed puts the treasury bond on its books, and the banker now has cash that he's got to figure out something to do with. Usually what happens with that cash is that it ends up going into the stock market. And so when you have an environment where the Fed is pumping in a lot of extra cash into the banking system and it has to go somewhere, you push up the market. When we were in the midst of Operation Twist not that many months ago, what the Fed was doing was it would be buying long-term Treasury bonds, but at the same time selling short-term Treasury bonds. So they were trying to twist the yield curve by pushing down the long end and pushing down the 30-year mortgage, most importantly, and keeping short-term rates where they were. The nice thing that's done is that means that all that higher interest payments that Uncle Sam is making on those long-term treasury bonds, well, those are just going into the pockets of the Fed. And at the point that the Congress decides to nationalize the Fed, they can retire all that long-term debt and all higher expense. And I wouldn't put it past Congress to do that. They might just decide, you know what, all that money at the Fed, that's just all our money anyway, so we're going to nationalize it, and there goes the debt ceiling problem. But in the meantime, all that money going into the banking system in exchange for treasury bonds has a huge positive effect on the stock market, trumping any and all other effects that might have mattered at some other time. And so what you have now is you have a market that's hanging on only one factor, the Fed printing money. Now, that's a huge thing. You know, if you're going to pick one factor to hang on, that'd be a good one. But it's one that can go away in a moment,
right,
as soon as 12 people in a committee room decide that they're going to pare back on it.
And this is what's been happening in Japan as well. I mean, you look at what's happened over the last several months, even though they say they're not intentionally trying to devalue the yen, wink, wink, the fact is that every time that we see the yen move in a downward fashion, getting weaker, the Nikkei moves higher, and it's been a pretty stellar move. But that's also in the face of when you see their recent information come out, for example, about their factory orders, industrial production. It's been horrid. I mean, absolutely terrible. Way, way outside the range of what anybody expected on the downside. And yes, I could see that weakening the currency because that makes sense, right? Economy's weaker, currency goes down. Okay. But that doesn't necessarily mean that markets should go up. But the point you're making is that the excess liquidity, because it's, you know, it's, in Japan, by the way, they do sometimes buy directly into the stock market, right? You've seen that. But
yeah.
Here, they do it a roundabout way. They create this excess liquidity. It's kind of like I view it as if you had a bowl of water and you fill it up with soap, like, you know, kitchen sink soap, and you put the water on really fast. Well, what happens is it fills the bowl, but also you get all this gigantic amounts of bubbles going everywhere. That's kind of how I view when they shove liquidity in the market. Stuff gets just kind of thrown in all sorts of places by accident. Which one
yeah,
of them?
You increase you got an extra amount of stuff in a finite size bag, and it starts gushing out the sides of it.
Yeah.
It used to be rumored that the Federal Reserve, while stating that they never did this, had actually secret futures accounts at all the big brokerage firms, and that when the plunge protection team wanted to step in and stop a crash, they could do it by the Fed secretly buying futures. That's never been proven, and you know, to keep a conspiracy like that under wraps for so many years would be really, really hard. So it's probably not been done, but what they do instead is they make a few phone calls to the banks, and the banks go ahead and do it, and the Fed says, we got your back in terms of we'll loan you the money to do it at a cheap rate. That's how it's typically been done. Right now, they're keeping the interest rates at more than a cheap rate. It's down at zero, and they're shoving handfuls of money into the mouths of the banks, and that's the way that the Fed has been able to manage this. And that kind of activity by the central bank can produce nice linear uptrends until it stops,
yeah.
Or until a few moments before the Fed decides to stop it, when the market figures out that it's going to stop and they start taking action ahead of time. You won't hear the announcement before the market reacts. The market will have reacted, and then we'll all be wondering what was it. And then a couple of days later, we'll hear that the Fed has decided they're going to change.
Right.
That's typically how it's going to work. You can't wait for the news and then decide to react. The market's going to do that beforehand.
Yeah, it's like musical chairs.
Little bit, yeah. People will all be rushing for the chairs, or they'll all be rushing for the exits to the dance hall when the fire breaks out,
yep.
And they can't all fit through the door at the same time.
Now, your chart that you put out is really interesting because you comment and annotate it. And what you do, the one I saw recently was the long-term view of this. You had the QE1, QE2, Operation Twist, and QE Infinity at this point. And historically, we saw that the most powerful move on the markets was the QE1 because it was brand new, lots of money in. QE2 was a little bit less, Operation Twist was a little bit less, and everybody was thinking, hey, the power of the Fed may start dissipating a little bit, but the recent rally, which, by the way, really isn't, there was no real commentary that was different except that they're going to do it forever, starting this year. It's interesting, though, when they stop or when they, if they don't have a scheduled purchase on a day or two or a week, whatever, but when they kind of in between, it is remarkable the amount of downtrend you see, sharp downtrend, in the markets right then.
Have you ever tried to quit caffeine? It's awful.
Yep,
I don't recommend it.
Yeah,
That's really what the market's going to be facing anytime the Fed tries to turn the faucet off and pare back on how fast they're pushing money in. We're used to all caffeine all the time, and the market's not going to have its own resources to call upon.
Well, wait. Are you telling me... I know you're not telling me this, but is this the theoretical inference that we can't have a stock market without the Fed's involvement? What kind of fun is that?
We can, and I think someday we will start to have one, and it'll be a really bumpy, rocky, awful transition as we try to wean ourselves off of the Fed's caffeine and try to have the market survive on its own. And the Fed has never managed a transition like that well. They've always screwed it up in some way, either doing it too fast or too slow. We got into the housing bubble of the mid-2000s because Greenspan was supposedly worried about his legacy, and he kept rates too low for too long. And then when Bernanke was in office and the problems were already starting to show, he kept rates too high for too long into 2007 and really pushed the market down a lot harder than it needed to have. If he had been much more responsive and done what he should have done, it would have turned out better. What we have watched historically is a comparison between the 2-year Treasury bond and the Fed funds target. And if those two are really, really close together, wherever the two of them go, you have a nice, orderly economy. When you get too big of a spread one way or the other between the 2-year and the Fed's rate, then you're either too stimulative or you're too repressive. Right now, 2-year notes at a quarter of a point, and Fed funds is at nothing. If the Fed would just inch up the Fed funds rate to a quarter of a point, and peg it to wherever the 2-year goes, and let the 2-year go where it's going to go instead of controlling it, we would have a much more orderly economy. We would have a much more normally responsive monetary system, the way you'd want a governor on an engine to work, where you don't put in too much fuel and then not enough fuel and have the engine RPM swinging all over the place. You'd have a much more nice and responsive way to do it. But the Fed hasn't seemed to figure out that trick.
Mm-hmm. Here's a crazy thought. As you were saying this, I had this very odd vision. we always all hear that Bernanke is a student of the Depression. I mean, that's a big thing, right? You know, he studied it, knows it backwards and forwards in terms of what happened, what went wrong, what they did right. But, you know, the fact is that really there's no way to really test his theory, right? I mean, how do you test it if it's not in a, you know, if he's not right there? So how crazy would it be that if, this is so weird, but how crazy would it be that if he actually kept rates really high to really bust this thing down just so he can test his theories?
Well, you know, if anybody wants to study up on how depression economics went, Amity Schley's book, The Forgotten Man, is a good place to start, because what went on with the depression that really kept us in a depression in the 30s for so long was not really anything that the Fed did. It was the executive branch and their efforts to try to micromanage the economy into a state of health. They wanted to take over this function or that function and tell people exactly what they had to do and get into everybody's business and raise a bunch of different little taxes all over the place so that you had multiple taxes, not nice simple taxes, but complicated and numerous taxes that were really hard to keep track of and really high, and it just stifled the heck out of innovation and business. Hmm. We're doing the same mistake there, which is outside of Bernanke's bailiwick. That's over in Congress and the White House doing those things, but we're doing the same mistakes that's keeping us in this slow, low-growth economy. We're not putting people back to work, and we are making the same mistakes in terms of what really does matter.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating that so many of the things that we've seen from the past, like what's happened in Japan, not recently, but in the past, the last 20 years, I'm trying to actually, reinflate their economy. Has it worked? The aging population. We just kind of keep on following some of these schemas, and it doesn't seem to be getting anywhere. But anyway, let's talk about
you started on a really good point, though, because Japan has a huge demographic problem.
Oh, yeah.
You cannot solve a demographic problem with monetary policy. You can make it better or worse, but you can't solve it. Europe has had the same demographic problem, and they have tried to get around it a little bit through immigration, by allowing people from North Africa and Eastern Europe to immigrate into France and Germany. And that's created all sorts of social tensions with people from different races and cultures and languages trying to intermingle with the population. Japan refuses to do that. They won't let anybody out who's not Japanese in any kind of numbers to speak of. And so they're just having to deal with the fact that they've got not very many people who are young and can work and a whole bunch of old people to feed. We have that same problem to some extent in that we have some lumpiness in our demographic curve. We're going to have a time coming up here in a few years when the echo boomers are going to hit their peak entrepreneurial years in the 30s. We had the baby boom that everybody knows about from 1946 to 64. All of those real old boomers are now, they're not starting dot-coms anymore. They're wanting to retire and watch the grandkids. There's an echo boom coming. But its peak year for births was in 1990. So the peak of the echo boom has just gotten out of college, or they're just about to get out of college. They're still living at home with mom and dad. They haven't found a job. In about 10 years, they'll be in their 30s. They'll be starting businesses. They'll be ramping up the economy and doing great things. But right now, they are not in a position to buy your McMansion from you or to buy your stock portfolio from you. And they're not in a position to really reinflate the economy because they're just not at the right age. When you're in your 30s, people are willing to take risks, want to go out and do things, and they have accumulated the knowledge and the wisdom and the capital of all types to go out and do that. And when the echo boom hits their 30s, about a decade from now, look for some really great economic times. But yep. we got a difficult period to slog through until then.
But it doesn't seem like anybody really cares anymore. I mean, I know this sounds kind of odd too, but it seems like everybody's accustomed, or at least they're just, you know, complacent about, okay, so we have 1% growth. I mean, the other day they got excited about the 1% increase in the retail sales number when about 0.5% was predicted, but...
And most of that was because of gasoline.
It's all gasoline. If you look at it's all gasoline, Tom. I'm like scratching my head going, what am I missing here? I must be missing something. And they're all excited about this. And discounting a lot of things. But okay, we know that markets go through those kind of cycles. But there's almost this really weird environment right now that it's all the headlines point to the right thing. You know, everybody's shooting for the record in this or the record in that, you know, turning into the upside. And it's almost as I don't want to call it optimistic, but it's almost as unrealistic as it was maybe when we were hitting the bottoms back in, you know, 2009.
And part of that celebration over higher retail sales was some new spin that you need to know how to take apart. The having nice, higher than expected retail sales in the first couple of months of 2013, right after a tax hike went through, and championing that is a way to argue that, see, tax hikes don't matter, so we can have more of them because they won't hurt. That's a really fallacious argument, but that's the argument that certain people want to put forth, and so that's why that news item got as much coverage as it did.
Now, let's not forget, though, that the second month, the reason why it was a little bit higher, was because all the tax refunds and all of the money that was on hold actually came in late. So people probably had a little bit more buying to be done. So really, if you want to just really look at this, we should take, you know, really 2 months, both months, and average them together. That would be fair. And then look at the gasoline situation and say, wait a minute, they're spending more money on gasoline. But as a matter of fact, gasoline was 5% of the total. If you look at there's a gigantic move of 5% change. The rest of the stuff was flat to negative.
But interestingly, there's a widespread belief that with higher gas prices, that tends to crowd out other consumer spending, which makes sense. You know, if I have to spend $10 more to fill up my tank, that's $10 that I won't go spend at McDonald's. That it makes sense. It just doesn't happen to match up with what the data actually say. Higher gas prices tend to correlate with higher overall spending in the other categories. It's not what people think. But that doesn't stop what the actual data say doesn't stop people from believing what they want to believe.
Does it possibly because it correlates backwards? In other words, because there's more spending, that is because there is maybe the economy is better, and because of that, there is more usage. Therefore, there's less gas, oil, and gasoline. Therefore, prices go up. In other words,
sure. If I drive to the mall one more time a month, and I'm using gas to get there. Or I'm working, there's sympathetic and feedback effects that make it all real complicated. But the point is that it is not the inverse correlation that so many people believe that it is.
Unless, I would say this, unless we get a real pop or something like that out of control.
Right. And if you have a nice slow increase in gasoline prices, people don't notice it. Gasoline is one of those funny things because there is nothing else that we consume that we see every day in 2-foot-tall letters, the price of. You know, I don't know what a chest x-ray costs. I don't really stay that much in tune with what a loaf of bread costs, even though I eat bread every day. But every day when I'm driving around, I see the price of gasoline. And so we become much more sensitive to changes in gasoline prices. Even though it's only 3% of all that we spend our money on, it still has much more of an effect on our psyches because of those 2-foot-tall letters.
Right. You know, I don't even know what a movie costs right now, although every time I go, that seems to be going up. And if I go 5 times a year, let's say, to the movie, I can't believe they're increasing.
And the seats keep getting smaller, but that may be another issue.
I think so. I think you're right about that. That's a good point. So now let's talk about some of the things you just mentioned at the beginning, which was this whole idea that, wait a minute, you know, things are getting, quote, I hate this overbought, oversold thing, by the way. The words somehow bother me, but we know what they mean. So, you know, this whole idea that when you look at the advanced decline lines and you calculate all your numbers and you come out with this look at, hey, things have gotten a little bit hot, we'll call it, okay, or a little cold. You see that right now where there was a complex structure under the zero for a while. Then we kind of popped up and did its thing. But where are we kind of generally over the last week where you saw that things are getting a little hot, heavy?
Well, the advanced decline numbers are still good.
Right.
They're just not rising as fast as they were a couple months ago. In other words, the rocket is still climbing higher, but it's climbing at a slower angle of ascent than it was initially. And that slowing of the ascent is actually a downward acceleration, which tends to precede downward actual movement by prices. We're also seeing lots of other warning signs, what I call dead canaries all over the coal mine. GE's share price tends to peak ahead of the Dow. And we're seeing that where the Dow is making higher highs, but GE is not confirming.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with copper prices. Copper has not confirmed the higher highs in the stock prices. Copper used to be a commodity metal that was economically sensitive. Now, since about 2007, copper is a financial asset, and it has a very strong correlation with the stock market, except that when the two of them disagree, it's usually copper that tells you the right story.
Right.
Copper is making lower highs and not confirming the stock market. So we're seeing all these things, all these canaries dying. The stock market's still celebrating and having a great time. Eventually, though,
if the Fed even hints at turning off the fire hose, then there's going to be that mad rush for the exit.
Now,
I think it's going to get especially acute after May. I'm not excited at all about any bullish prospects for the market between May and October of this year, and that's probably when the Fed is going to start trying to reintroduce the pain and taking the training wheels off and having the market go on its own.
Hmm. Now, you mentioned the copper. That's interesting. You also, I know, a lot of times look at lumber prices. What's going on there? I mean, we're depending on where you are in the world, well, I should say in the United States, depending on where you are, I mean, I'm starting to hear some really bizarre stories about, like, people climbing over each other again to try to buy houses on the east side of Fort Lauderdale. But
lumber prices are actually back up to near all-time highs. But it's not just lumber prices that's so fun to watch. If you look at the commitment of traders data on lumber futures and what the commercial traders are doing, you can actually get insights about what's ahead for the stock market. And right now, that doesn't say really good things. But the high prices of lumber is an artifact of coming out of the housing boom and bust. A lot of mills got shut down because they couldn't make a profit on lumber that nobody was buying. It takes a while to start those back up again, and if you get a sudden surge in demand for 2x4s, then the existing mills say, "Okay, I'll sell it to you, but for another 10 points higher." And so there's been this rush. Lumber is also something that costs a lot to store. You know, if you had $100,000 worth of lumber, or $100,000 worth of gold, the storage medium is a whole different kind of idea. You can't just put it in a drawer in a safe deposit box. It takes a big warehouse, and it's got to be climate controlled and have fire suppression, and then hopefully is near a road or a railroad. So it takes a lot to store lumber, and we cannot inventory it as well to handle surges in demand like this. And so we're seeing some fascinating things in lumber prices.
Well, fascinating. Wait till they come out with a lumber ETF that has to hold the thing. That would be fun. You know, that's nothing. That's my pet peeve. I mean, they're trying to come out with all these ETFs, like the aluminum ETF and all this. I mean, I'm thinking, wait a minute. I get it. I understand why we want to, be able to trade this stuff. But doesn't that kind of like make stuff more expensive for me if you're going to be using it to, pile into this ETF?
Well, and the storage costs really make that untenable because, if you store gold, gold's not going to spoil or get termites or catch on fire. It's still going to be gold at the end of a month going by. Lumber, you have a huge storage risk and a huge storage cost. We were seeing huge differences a couple of years ago between the near month and the out month prices of lumber, where the out month was far higher. I mean, you could buy spot lumber, rent a warehouse, and pay for a bunch of money to rent the warehouse and sell a forward contract and pocket 36% return because the spread between them was different. So it's really hard to arbitrage away those price spreads in lumber like you can in the financials. It's just because of the storage difficulties. But that's kind of gone away, and now we're seeing the near-month price is really high, and far-month is looking a little bit more iffy about the prospects.
I got the perfect place to store it. Any of the national forests.
Yeah, that's the best way to store it.
It's a natural storage facility, right?
When you store your that's timber. When you store your timber standing, you actually get a 5% return on it because that's about the amount of aggregation that comes along every year.
Listen, I appreciate you coming along, Tom McClellan. Listen, I encourage everybody, seriously, great reads is between his weekly commentary, which he puts out, wouldn't you guess, weekly. And
we have a weekly chart and focus that anybody can sign up for free. They can see one chart a week, and it's kind of a cool thing to talk about. You can just sign up on our website, no strings attached. You won't get junk mail from us. It's just a kind of a fun way to look at what we're thinking about.
Yeah, and then also his daily commentary, which gives you a very in-depth look at a variety of indicators like the McClellan Oscillator, and also gives you some of his rising star picks from individual positions, and also talks about a variety of these other commodities. Really good stuff. I mean, I read it all the time, really. And I mean, when I say all the time, regularly, every day. And I think it's great, and it's one of those things that gives you, I think, very focused insight into really directional bias, as well as, kind of what's happening, but looking at it without the excess kind of newsy, headline-driven, just the facts. Thank you very much. Here's what's happening. Here's what it looks like. That may not be exactly right, but this is kind of the, more probable focus of this. So you're great, and I really appreciate, all that you do, and of course, for your great writing and your insight.
And our website is mcoscillator.com. So it's like a McNugget, except it's a McOscillator. named for the McClellan Oscillator that my parents created.
Mm-hmm.
Go check it out. We've got a lot of free articles in the Learning Center, lots of things to read.
Yeah, it's great stuff there. I really appreciate it. We'll put links all over this particular show notes for this episode. I appreciate it, Tom.
Okay, Andrew.
All right, bye-bye. And our second guest today, we have Carter Wirth, who is the chief market technician for Oppenheimer. And, you know, you've probably seen him on CNBC. He shows up there a lot and kind of goes over the charts and gives you some really good information. And a lot of times in really good basic terminology. Because, Carter, how are you, by the way?
Good, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
So, you know, I mean, there's different ways. There's all these different, you know, things we always talk about, like oscillators and the, you know, MACD. And, I mean, it doesn't have to be that difficult, right?
Well, interestingly, I myself don't use any of those things. They're, if you will, those are very new permutations. There are now officially 140 recognized price oscillators. and imagine trying to use all 140, meaning they're popular ones everyone knows, like stochastics or MACD or Bollinger Band or Fibonacci or DeMarc or RSI. But the issue with that kind of thing is that they have no history. Charting is hundreds of years old. They've been charting the rice market for 400 years. The basic study of supply and demand, trying to find inflection points, trying to find those rare moments when something is likely to break out or break down, to bounce or to fail. And there are no shortcuts in life, and there are no shortcuts in the market. There's no sort of magic formula, yes, if you will, magic beans. This one tells me to buy or sell this indicator oscillator. I have found that they have no efficacy. I've done a lot of back testing and things, but people love them. And look, I'm just one practitioner. You can use anything you want. It's not for me.
Well, I think that a lot of times that some of those things that they're taught that, okay, if this crosses this, hey, that's a buy. I mean, kind of like the golden cross or, you know, a death cross. But factually, that I think that once the populace knows or at least believes those kind of things, they become, not worth anything. They're just not valuable anymore.
I think that's largely correct. Once something is a well-observed phenomenon, it's not as robust in tests or effective because it's, you know, it gets arbitraged away.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So let's talk a little bit about, I know you study behavioral finance and you're looking at supply-demand, which you just mentioned. And let's talk about current market conditions in terms of, where we are. It seems to me that if we look at things like a Z-score of the S&P 500 away from its 200-day moving average, we're way out of range. When we look at things like, the current move recently and kind of lack of correction and constant money flowing in, tell me a little bit about your kind of vision of what this is looking like, feels like, and from the charting aspect.
Right. Well, as it relates to the S&P, we could talk about any other index, but that's obviously the big one in the United States. The principles are this, that we have a four-year bull market, and we've returned to the well-defined tops of 2000 and 2007. So we are just now at those very precise levels, at the 1570 plus minus level. And so is it a time to be buying more or to be trimming and harvesting gains? We would be in the latter category. We think it's time to be trimming, harvesting gains. And that's a function of not only is it a four-year bull market and we're at all-time highs, but individual securities in many instances are very, very steep, sort of what you're intimating, above their moving averages or what have you. And in principle, typically, yes, intermediate tops are identified by just this, rapid price increases, when everyone's expecting price to go higher, just as intermediate bottoms are typically identified by rapid price declines when everyone's trying to get out. So the move off of the November low, November 16th is low, and we've gone 4 months straight up. We're essentially annualizing at something in the order of 60-70%. Markets have never gone up at that rate in any 12-month period. So we were down at 1350 in November, mid-November. Here we are mid-March, and we're at 15. Call it 1550, 200 S&P points. It's euphoric. Yes, it's crowded. I guess I would say this way: you have confidence is good. Yeah, and mm-hmm. That's what makes markets go. And then confidence to its extreme gets to complacency. People feel certain, and that leads to hubris, and that leads to disaster. You know, so we're well past the confidence stage. We're well into the complacent stage. We're borderline into the hubris stage,
mm-hmm.
where everyone's pretty cocksure, pretty certain that everything's fine. And I would say it's time to be trimming longs into this kind of move.
And now, I guess the way we can really see that also is the way the there's buy the dip, and then there's the kind of, you know, when something really moves down, the buying into it. And but there's something about buying the dip when maybe the S&P moves down 2 points, and they have to seemingly race in to grab it at that point. You know, it's like, you know, there's no rest here. Now, what's interesting, I find, is that can come from a lot of places, right? It could come from mutual funds that are trying to deploy assets over a period of time. It could come from, mm-hmm. you know, just algos that are just set to just, you know, bang it when it comes down a little bit. A lot of different ways. But what I find interesting here is that there is a time, and there always is going to be a time, that extra kind of flush in runs out. And when that kind of evaporates, what happens then?
Well, that's it. You get to be a crowded position where there's no one left to buy. And a lot of people say there's only second inning, that the retail investor has been gone for 4 years. They're just starting to enter the market. There's plenty of money to come to be added. That's one way to look at it. The other way is that the retail investor has started putting money in. The last 2 months are at or near record inflows. Hedge fund long exposure is at the highest level since 2008. And the basic people are involved. They're in. And this is the time to be going the other way.
Yeah, I mean, because you could bring the point up that the retail investor in is always the wrong side. Well,
right.
Historically.
Pretty historically, that's right.
Unfortunately. So is there any particular sectors, you know, assuming for a moment that you don't have the edict that you have to be in equities, you know, that, because, you know, when we listen to a lot of people that are talking, that are writing, you know, they have a absolute mantra, or they have a by design maybe in their portfolio, they have to be in equities at a certain point. Let's kind of throw that away. We don't have to be in equities. We don't have to be in bonds. We don't have to be in anything. Okay. All we have to be in is nothing, mattress. Where is the best place now with that as the backdrop to put money?
It's certainly not the bond market. It's certainly not gold. Presumptively real estate. If one had to just be in one bucket, I would say real estate's probably the best place. But a broad exposure, not just residential properties, but, you know, a broad exposure to various categories within real estate. Mm-hmm. But within the stock market, again, one, as you said, doesn't have to be in at all. But I think the least desirable place to be is consumer discretionary names. They, as a sector, that has outperformed the S&P 5 years in a row. And at this point, interestingly, you're starting to show some real distribution. A lot of names starting to roll over, not participating in the market's real strength. And that's usually a harbinger of worse things to come, whether it's because taxes have gone up or that the job market isn't really all that great despite the improvement. Who knows, frankly, but the action in the stocks is poor in many consumer discretionary names.
What I think is really interesting, and I know you focus on the technicals, is that last quarter, the earnings that came in, a lot of the consumer discretionary names, the management was very concerned about the outlook for a number of different reasons, okay?
Right.
Stocks would come in, maybe they meet, of course, we're playing the estimate game here. They would do their thing, and then they would just rocket higher. We saw a few companies come out recently with results. We saw Aeropostale, we saw Azumiez, and they just got, you know, blown out. Ulta came out with a better number. So the question is, you know, what is that also that, management is saying one thing and then investors are doing another?
Well, investors are dumping these stocks pretty aggressively. Because you say Ulta, I mean, that one today is down 15%. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're dropping down $13. That's distributive behavior. When you have stocks that are dropping up, you're seeing PetSmart, you're seeing in Foot Locker, you're seeing Hibbett Sports, you're seeing Limited, you're seeing casual diners in general. And those are a great leading indicator. One of the things about casual diners, and I had started as a fundamental analyst before I figured out that that's all a bunch of nonsense and that it's the answers are in the charts. But casual diner restaurants and stocks like that are a great way to get a real feel for consumer behavior, because it's so very discretionary. If you're feeling tight and you're concerned, you don't have to go out and eat. Mm-hmm. Right? You could just shut that down.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, you're starting to see that kind of thing, the very bad action in some of the casual dining stocks and very good action in packaged foods,
mm-hmm.
whether it's because people are staying home and cooking themselves. But, you know, notice things like Hormel Foods and Campbell Soup all
right.
making new highs. And,
right.
you know, that's not random, right, because they're not exactly growth stocks, but they're Conagra and things like that, it reflects the fact that I think people are not quite as well off as the so-called job recovery would suggest.
Yeah, I hear you. All right. Well, I appreciate it, Carter Worth over at Oppenheimer, taking the time to kind of give us some of the wisdom of all that you have, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. That was all a lot to take in between Tom McClellan and, of course, Carter Worth. And Carter Worth, you can see quite often on CNBC. He's on all the time talking about charts and all that. I think they call him Charter Worth, which is great. But he is a very good technical analyst. And even with technical analysis, you know, you can't get it right all the time. But when you can combine it with fundamental analysis and a few other techniques, I think that you're better off than having one versus the other. And even with that, it may not always be, getting the best direction, because markets these days are somewhat thin in that regard. And also you have the problem that when you're looking at all of the government influence on markets with quantitative easing and with manipulation of deposits and with pushing money in and out of markets and constantly tinkering with every component of it, as well as the globalization of the economies, you know, it's a little bit more difficult because everything is so interrelated and, you know, essentially the butterfly effect. You know, the butterfly flaps its wings over in Asia somewhere and we get a hurricane in Idaho, you know, or a tornado in Idaho, I guess it would be. So with that, I think that, you know, we have to be very much apprised of all the different strategies, techniques, and ways to look at markets and make sure that you are doing so with, you know, good charting platforms, good fundamentals, and of course, garbage in, garbage out. You got to make sure you have the best information available, because I've seen a lot of times where people are looking at things on the web and they don't have the right pricing as you see in other places. And if you're looking at a particular website that maybe adjusts their dividends incorrectly or doesn't do splits right or whatever it may be, what happens is that, you know, you may see a moving average that looks right or an indicator that looks right, but you know what? Everybody else may be looking at something different. You want to look at what's most, I think, most likely to be looked at by professionals, because those are the ones that handle most of the money that's out there. And by doing so, you can be better aligned in directional moves, trends, and what they're looking at. So just keep that as an item, a food for thought, something that you want to consider. And with that, we're going to end this week's episode. I appreciate you coming on and joining me. Thanks again for all those great reviews on iTunes. And if you haven't done so already, please do so. You can check out it on iTunes or all sorts of podcast, you know, players on Android and on iPhone and on whatever else that you use out there on your computer. You can listen and make sure to tell your friends, because I'd really appreciate it. We'll be up with DH Unplugged this week, talking about all sorts of nonsense and good things and kind of picking out what's happening in the markets and making mincemeat out of it, and then bringing it back and finding some really good things as well. So make sure to check that out when you can. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.